what evidence do they have for that? And equally, opening up the conversation with your vets. If your vets are recommending a certain food, never be afraid to ask why. And it's really important then to start looking at all of the different factors that go into it. So looking at the ingredients, looking at the analytical constituents of your dog's food, that's the macronutrient profiles, like the protein, the fats, the carbohydrates, that kind of a thing.
Are you crazy about Chihuahuas? Maybe you're wondering if a Chihuahua is the right dog for you. Perhaps you have a training or a behavior struggle. Well, look no further. Here you will find expert opinions, honest views, training and behavior advice, and much more on the Chihuahua Podcast. And now, allow me to welcome your hosts, Kate Masterton and Haley Miles. Over to you, ladies.
Welcome to the Chihuahua Podcast. My name is Haley Miles. I am your host. And today, Kate and I are joined by another one of our industry experts. This time we are joined by the lovely Alyssa Ralph, who is going to talk to us about canine nutrition. Alyssa is highly qualified in both dog behavior and dog nutrition and works uniquely on the interface between the two in her consultancy business, Holistic Pet Services. She has a focus on aggression and reactive dogs and creates bespoke plans for these dogs, which encompass all aspects of health and well-being to enact real change in their behavior. Welcome, Alyssa, to the Chihuahua Podcast. How are you?
Hello, I'm really good, thank you. Really pleased to be here. Are you guys okay?
We are great. How are you, Kate?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
We are honored that you're on to speak to us because we are really interested in the subject of canine nutrition and we have a lot of questions for you. But so many questions.
Fantastic topic.
Yeah. So just quick, how did you go from being a behaviorist to doing a lot in canine nutrition? And how'd you get started in that?
I kind of had a little bit of a head start in that I grew up with my mum as a human nutritionist. So she was always kind of whispering things in my ear about nutrition. The switch really happened about 2 years ago when I got diagnosed with a chronic illness. And a lot of the management in that is nutrition. And as I was researching that for my own benefit, I started to see an awful lot of parallels in my dog as well. So for anyone that doesn't know, my dog is the lovely Dougal, and he has a lot of anxiety. And I started to see parallels in what I was researching, because what I was doing for myself was a lot of human nutrition related to stress. And it was, again, that whole holistic approach to it. And I just started seeing these parallels in Dougal and Dougal's behavior and nutrition. And it just really spurred me on. So I went through, I read a load of fundamental textbooks cover to cover. I'm a massive book nerd, so that really helped. And then I ended up doing my postgrad diploma in canine and feline nutrition as well, which has really just set me up. And now I don't really have interest in setting up purely as a nutritionist. I really like this little space in between behavior and nutrition where we still have so much to learn, but the research is really just coming out and helping dog owners to navigate that themselves for their own dogs as well. Because yeah, it's a really interesting place to be researching and working in.
Thank you so much for coming on to talk about this hotly debated topic. I feel like it's a complete minefield, isn't it? Dog food, what do we feed our dogs?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So how do people navigate that? Because I feel like there's the vets say one thing, comparison sites say another thing. What are we supposed to be looking for and what are we supposed to be doing? Because I find it confusing. I can imagine our listeners also find it super confusing.
Like you say, Kate, it is an absolute minefield and everyone has their own opinion. So the important thing is to always look for reasons and look for evidence. So if you are using one of the dog food comparison sites, it's looking at why they've scored it the way they have. What evidence do they have for that? And equally, opening up the conversation with your vets. If your vets are recommending a certain food, never be afraid to ask why. Why is this one best for my dog? Because a lot of the vet recommended foods will be prescription diets. If your dog has an issue that needs treating, such as chronic kidney disease or pancreatitis, a lot of the times the prescription diets are really well formulated and are what's going to be best to get them back on their paws nice and quickly. But if it's just for a generic, average, healthy dog, you need to start questioning why is that food being recommended? Because we're in a state now where the pet food industry has exploded and there are so many different options and everyone has a little bit of a biased view. So as a dog owner, the best thing that you can do is take little bits from everyone and just look for somewhere in the middle. My favorite advice is always kind of in the middle of the spectrum where it's not really left wing, it's not really right wing, it's just somewhere kind of mingling around in the middle, because it's the same when you hear stories about events that happened. It's always going to be somewhere between the two stories. And the same thing goes for nutrition, because there's so much that goes into it. But it's also, if you've ever heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect, it's one of those typical things where you start off and you know absolutely nothing, but you think you know everything. And then the more you know, the less you realize you actually know.
Yeah.
And then you start coming out of that at the end when you actually start to really get the research together and start having a proper grasp on it. And it's really important then to start looking at all of the different factors that go into it. So looking at the ingredients, looking at the analytical constituents of your dog's food, that's the macronutrient profiles, like the protein, the fats, the carbohydrates, that kind of a thing. And then looking at what your dog actually needs, because every dog is an individual as well. So it's, you can start with a baseline and go, okay, I want to feed my dog a dry food. I found this dry food that works really nicely for a lot of dogs. You might try it with your dog and find that it doesn't necessarily work. So then it's going, okay, why don't I think this is working? And if you're ever in doubt, obviously there's a whole field now of canine nutritionists that are out there to help, and you can get consults with them relatively easily these days. So it's not the dark art that it used to be. There's a lot of people out there willing to help. And if you're ever stuck as well, so I also do some freelance writing for a company called Your Dogs Club. It says what it does on the tin. It's all about dogs. And in the blog, you've got loads on there about nutrition, because that's the most misunderstood aspect of dog ownership. So there's loads of blogs and things available in terms of how to read dog labels, what you look for, what's a good baseline for an average dog, that kind of a thing, to just really upskill yourself and know what you're looking at when it comes to dog food as a baseline.
There's so much confusion around the ingredients list. Does the first ingredient matter?
It does, but it's more from a marketing perspective. So legally, the ingredients label has to go in descending order. So the top ingredient has to be the one that's most prevalent. And then the last ingredient is the one that's in there the least amount. However, depending on the brand, they play with it. So you've got these things called ingredient grouping and ingredient splitting. So ingredient grouping is where, say, a food is predominantly cereal based, but the UK market especially has gotten quite wise to that. And now everyone is looking for the first ingredient to be meat based.
Meat. Yeah,
exactly. So if they know that carbs would actually come out if they just listed it normally, what they might do is look down the list and just go, okay, so we've maybe got a bit of chicken in there, we've got a bit of duck, we've got a bit of beef, we've got a bit of lamb, and we've got some salmon oil. So they might then group it together and call it animal derivatives or animal products, and then shoot it up to the top of the list. So that's ingredient grouping that you do need to be really wary of. And then ingredient splitting is the reverse. So you also have the grains aspect, or anything else that isn't as good, where it's the ingredients are split out. So it's not grouped together to bring them up, they're split out to push them down the list. So if you have a term such as cereals, it's usually because they've got things like wheat or corn in it. But equally, if you see just wheat in the label, or you just see corn, or you just see barley, it's all additive. So you need to be aware that all of that comes into the carbohydrate content. And that's where looking at the analytical constituents can really be helpful. And if you've never noticed the analytical constituents on a bag of dog food before, it's usually just below or just to the right of the ingredients list. And it will always be listed out like protein, fat, fiber, inorganic matter, and then maybe some moisture, maybe some omega-3 in there. But that's what you're looking for.
So many foods that I see when I go into a client's house, and I'm going to do like a behavior consult kind of thing, and I'm talking to them about the dog's behavior, and I want to see the food. Very often I will see the food, and you know, it's, say it's dry food, and it does say meat derivatives as a first ingredient. Can I just, before we move on, can I just ask you what meat derivatives actually are?
Yeah. And this is the thing, is so vague that it literally could mean anything. So right. Most commonly, it's things like fat from one thing, meat from another, and they just combine it all together. It could be include byproducts. Byproducts aren't the necessarily evil thing that we've all come to think they are. So sometimes including things like the organ meat, the offal, things like the bones, the hooves, the feet, actually including them can be really beneficial if done correctly. So that's not a bad thing in itself. But as a general rule of thumb, I avoid foods that say meat derivatives purely because you don't know what's in there. So legally, they can change the ingredients batch to batch. If you have a dog that might have an intolerance, feeding them the same food could then flare it up in one batch, but not another. So it leads to a lot of confusion around that. But also you don't know the quality of the food. So the mineral and the vitamin makeup will be changing again, batch to batch. So you're never truly sure what's in there. So I'd always advise looking for an ingredients list that is as specific as possible. So one that even goes down into the type of meat that it is. So for example, the higher quality kibbles, you get listed fresh chicken, dehydrated chicken, chicken fat, salmon oil, and they'll have it all listed out and very specific. So you know exactly what you're feeding.
To me, it makes more sense to actually know what the ingredients actually are. So I always look for an actual meat that's named like turkey or chicken or something, you know, so you actually know what's in it, not just meat derivative, you know?
Yeah. And it can be really important as well if you're looking at the wider impact of what you feed your dog, because generally the foods that name their meat sources, they tend to have more of an idea of the farms that the meat is sourced from, and they can look at whether that farm is ethically done, whether the animals are being raised with welfare in mind, what the carbon footprint is, if they're locally sourced or they're being imported in from the States or something. So having a named protein has so many different benefits that you can kind of shoot off on and have a look at.
I was just going to say, actually, when I go into someone's house and I'm looking at the bag of food, I do suggest they change the food if the first ingredient is meat derivatives or cereal. So for someone who grabs a bag of food now and goes, oh my God, what's the first ingredient on my dog's dried food? And it's meat derivatives or cereals, then that's probably, it's time to change, right?
Generally, yes, because usually those kind of ingredients are correlated with the poorer quality food brands.
Yeah.
So this is where, you know, certain dog comparison food sites can come in handy. I'm not going to say which ones are good and which ones are bad, but there is a better one. And there are some really good information available to help you kind of navigate that. But as a general rule of thumb, meat derivatives and cereals are associated with poorer quality kibbles. And it's worth seeing if you can afford to get a better quality, because This is the big controversy with nutrition at the moment. Is you will have no doubt have seen all of these fires going off on social media. There's even a hashtag that's hashtag kibble is murder, which is just horrendous.
Oh my God. Okay.
Ownership. Yeah. And it, you know, kibble is not murder. It's come an awful long way to the point where, you know, you can actually get an awful lot of health benefits out of a kibble these days. And it comes down to what the owner can afford, because at the end of the day, feeding your dog is more important than feeding your dog a high quality kibble. If you can't afford a high quality kibble, or you can't afford to feed fresh, feed whatever you can afford, and it keeps them alive day to day. Don't worry about the nuances. Like, if you can afford to, then absolutely do, but don't push yourself and your family to the brink of homelessness because you're looking to feed your dog even better.
You mentioned fresh feeding there. So with human nutrition, we're always told, you know, avoid processed food and go more for fresh and back to what the original, back to the original ingredient. That doesn't seem to be such the case with dogs, but would it be better for dogs to be fed more fresh ingredients, even if we are feeding a kibble base, if we add some fresh ingredients in there?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm on a little bit of a personal vendetta at the moment against the word processed, because we've come to see processed food as this devil thing. But what we actually mean when we talk about processed foods in a negative light is the fact that they usually have added fat, added salt, added sugar. So it's those things that you really need to be looking out for, rather than the word processed or anything that comes prepackaged. Especially when it comes to dog food, because if we feed any brand at all, even if it does purport to be fresh, it's coming in a packet. Yeah. So we need to have a look at kind of what those words actually mean. But yes, there is huge benefit to feeding fresh if you can. So a fully formulated fresh food diet that you cook at home is kind of the pinnacle of good nutrition, as long as you formulated it in kind of in collaboration with a nutritionist to make sure it's complete and balanced for your individual dog. A lot of people, though, can't afford that, especially with the rise of cost of living. Like, even we are struggling to feed ourselves, like as humans, it's getting increasingly difficult. So if you need to feed kibble, then you can still pop some fresh fruits and veggies onto there to help the overall health of your dog. So broccoli is a really good one. That's also a prebiotic. You could also put a little bit of sweet potato on top. I tend to advise steering away from the legume family. So that's things like green beans, peas, chickpeas, lentils, purely because there's research ongoing, so it's not conclusive, that it could be related to a heart disease called dilated cardiomyopathy, which is basically where the heart muscles go all floppy. So it's potentially linked to that legume family. So I tend to avoid them as much as possible. But like I say, it's not conclusive yet. So it's not worth any panic if you are feeding frozen peas and green beans. But, you know, fresh fruits and veggies on top of your dog's kibble can really actually reduce the risk of certain diseases, even such as cancer. So there was a good scientific paper that came out not too long ago that looked at the impacts of adding veggies to our dog's kibble and what that did for their health. And it had really good benefits. So always, always try and do that if you can, even if it's just scraping off a little bit of the veg on your plate. As long as it's not being cooked in butter or oil and it's not doused in gravy and whatnot, then it's good for them as well.
Yeah, and so many dogs love vegetables, don't they? Actually, Bo does love peas. I'm a little bit worried now. She does love peas, but she doesn't have them, like, you know, it's not many, but I'm interested in that kind of ongoing research. But she loves broccoli, she loves sweet potato and stuff like that. My next question was going to be actually raw, fresh kibble. What is the difference and how do we navigate this absolute minefield if you don't know where to go, where to start?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite questions, because all of those ones that you've just told me are umbrella terms. So you've got kibble, mm-hmm. you've got wet food, you've got raw food, and you've got fresh food. What you will generally find, and I'm probably going to get some hate messages for this, is that raw food advocates will really, really push it and say raw food is the best. You can't do any better than raw food. There is an awful lot of science out there disproving that, which I can get into in a little bit, but it is an umbrella term. And within it, you have all sorts of different qualities of offerings. The same with kibble. You could have a poor quality kibble and a great quality kibble. Same for wet food, like say raw food and fresh food. If you don't formulate that with a nutritionist, you could end up promoting all sorts of diseases and malnutrition deficiencies to your dog. So it's less about the umbrella terms compared with one another. It's more about the quality within the umbrella term. So I always say, pick what type of food you want based on what works for you. If you're traveling a lot, if you can't afford it, if you've got a really strict budget for your dog's food, if you need it to have a longer shelf life, kibble is going to be the better one for you. If you don't care how much space it takes up in storage, you've got plenty of pantry space, you can spend a little bit more than kibble, but not as much as raw, then maybe wet food is good. If you have a huge freezer and can handle the costs of raw food and the really strict hygiene measures that go hand in hand with it, then raw might be the one for you. And then equally for fresh, if you have the income and the time availability to cook all your dog's foods from scratch, then you might want to consider that. But pick one that works for you and your lifestyle, and then look within each one for the higher quality that you can get for your dog.
So there's no need to feel guilty, you know, if you can't do this or that. And if you are feeding a good quality kibble, that's actually okay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I myself, and honestly, my clients can never believe this when I tell them, I don't have the time or the spare income to feed fresh for my dog. So whilst I think it's fantastic and I wish I could do it, so I feed my dog a mix of high quality kibbles and then I supplement it with fresh veggies where I can. Because it's what works for me. It's what works for our lifestyle. And he's super healthy. He's one of the healthiest dogs I've ever met. And you should never, ever feel guilty about what you can offer your dog. Because at the end of the day, if you're trying your best, that's what matters. If you're trying to keep them healthy, if you're even thinking about their food, then that's what counts. As long as you're not just going, okay, well, I don't want to finish this Domino's pizza, have a slice. And then, oh, I don't want to finish my cup of tea. Here, just finish that for me. As long as you're actually putting thought into it, then there's no need to feel guilty at all.
Yeah, careful consideration of what is going into your dog's mouth.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So we're all aware that the food that we feed our children can affect behaviour. Foods with high amounts of colouring and additives is the same with dogs. Can the food that we feed our chihuahuas affect their behaviour in similar ways?
Absolutely. So this is where I really come in with my clients, is behavior and food are so inextricably linked. Like we even know that a lot of the neurotransmitters that we look at for our brain health and our emotional health, like serotonin and dopamine, are actually manufactured an awful lot as well in our guts. And our guts has the nickname of the second brain because they are just so intertwined and there's so much communication between them that drives behavior. So first of all, I just want to cover kind of colorants and additives and those kind of things. Additives, as a word, not something to be scared of. What you will see an awful lot on dog food packaging is there's a section in there, usually under ingredients, that says additional ingredients or additives. Usually those are more supplement-based things that help just balance out the trace minerals and vitamins that are in the food to make sure it's perfect for your dog. So that's not really a concern. The concern is then, like you say, if you see anything that is colorants or things that are like E-numbers and things, you will see these again in the lower quality kibbles predominantly. So as you probably all know which one I'm talking about, but there's a kibble that you can get that has little biscuits that are colored red and yellow and orange and green.
Dog Smarties, yay.
Exactly. I mean, first of all, dogs are red, green, colorblind. So they're not going to see an awful lot of the color range that's in there. It's purely for our benefit. And it doesn't really affect the taste either. Dogs also have really limited tasting abilities. So a lot of their taste comes from what they can smell. And they are not going to care if there is a color in the dog food to make it look brighter. It's purely for our benefit. So I would always advise, if you're looking for a kibble and you can see one that's colorful, just go, I'm not getting that one just because it looks pretty. I'm going to go for the really boring looking one, because the chances are they've put the money more on the quality ingredients. If you do end up with one that has those kind of colorants in it, it can really have an effect on hyperactivity. And it's the same with the carbohydrate quantity and carbohydrate quality as well. So you'll find that if a food uses things like refined grains rather than whole grains, that basically removes all of the fiber and all of the trace minerals and vitamins from the carbohydrate. So if we think about brown rice versus white rice, brown rice is brown because it still has that outer coating on it. So it's still got that fibrous husk that has an awful lot of benefit to it. White rice is when that husk has been removed and it's basically just starch, which means that when you eat that, it gets converted straight into sugar. So if you have a look at your dog's food and it just says rice rather than whole rice or brown rice, chances are it's white rice, and it will just hit your dog's blood sugar like a steam train, and they will go soaring high as a toddler on Skittles for an hour or so, and then they will have the inevitable crash down after, when you end up with the grumpy toddler tantrums as they just are overtired and they don't know how to handle themselves.
Just cutting in, because that's really interesting, because we have a lot of chihuahuas that are reactive and bark and lunge and really kind of, I mean, some people say, oh, my chihuahua's hyperactive. So just looking at the rice thing, because, you know, a lot of kibble says chicken and rice, yes, salmon and rice, whatever it may be, or salmon and potato. But the rice, so it should say brown rice.
Not just rice. So this isn't the thing for every single food out there, but as a rule of thumb, if it has brown rice in it, they will be singing and dancing about it because it is more expensive.
Right. Okay.
They will be going, brown rice. If they just say rice and it's vague, usually err on the side of caution and assume white rice.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then you just mentioned as well potato in there. So white potato, similar thing to white rice, in that it does really impact the blood sugar. And then they can come crashing down. There are other variables that can impact it, but as a rule of thumb, I like to avoid white potato as far as possible. The better carb source to look for in terms of blood sugar is sweet potato, because mm-hmm. it has a much lower what's called glycemic index, which means that it impacts the blood sugar an awful lot less. It helps to regulate it over the course of the day, meaning you're not going to have those peaks and troughs in energy levels quite so much as if you were feeding a more starchy carb. But I also just wanted to say, you mentioned that an awful lot of the chihuahuas are reactive. And this is something that's really close to my heart, because there is an awful lot of research out there that looks at how diet can influence aggression and reactivity. And a lot of the research is actually in humans, but we can actually translate that an awful lot to dogs and kind of take inference from it. Obviously, it's not conclusive until we have the studies in dogs, but we share very similar digestive tracts, so we can really have a look at that. And then you see that there's all sorts of variation in what we can feed our dogs or feed ourselves that influences behavior. So for dogs that are reactive, I always recommend having a look at diet, because there is a myth that high protein diets cause reactivity. They don't necessarily. It's a lot more kind of complex than that. Because the truth of it actually comes when you start looking at what makes up the protein, and that is all of the different amino acids. And then if you think that amino acids, once they make it into our dog's bloodstream, are what they use to create all sorts of other proteins. So it's new cells, new tissues, new muscles, neurotransmitters, things like that. When I say neurotransmitters, I'm talking about things like serotonin and dopamine, the brain chemicals that help everything kind of fire off in the brain correctly. Then it all comes down to the makeup of the protein, and different protein sources will have different amino acid profiles. But as a general rule of thumb, the amino acid we really want to harbor for reactive and aggressive dogs is tryptophan, because that is a precursor to serotonin, which is a happy hormone and can help our dogs to really relax. You'll notice that in a lot of the behavioral medications for things like anxiety,
yep.
They're what's called SSRIs. They work on the serotonin pathway to basically increase the amount of serotonin that's available for a receiving synapse. So it's helping all the serotonin float around in the brain. If we increase the amount of tryptophan that's being absorbed into the blood and then therefore into the brain, we are increasing the amount of serotonin that's available to our dog. So we're making them happier. But we can't just give them protein and go, hopefully that'll give them more tryptophan. Tryptophan is also highly competitive with the other amino acids, trying to all basically clamber into our dog's brain. So what we need to do to help tryptophan get there is to basically reduce the amount of all the other amino acids and increase how much tryptophan is available. What that looks like is a low protein diet. So around 20% on a dry matter basis should be protein. And then you supplement it with an L-tryptophan supplement. So there are loads of different brands out there. If you wanted to have a look, some ones that come to mind is NutriCalm, which a lot of vets will be able to prescribe. You can also get it in YouMove Calming Care. And even the brand AOK9, they have one called Calm K9 as well. But if you just have a Google of L-tryptophan supplementation for dogs, quite a few different options will come up. And then if you supplement that with a lower protein diet, that can really help. In the same breath, it's also worth looking at things like carbohydrate content, because carbohydrate shunts it across the blood-brain barrier, so it helps absorption again, and omega-3 content. But I have a whole blog on this topic on my website if you wanted to have a look in a bit more detail with some of the science-y backgrounds as well.
It's so fascinating, honestly. It's really interesting because we have so many chihuahuas that are aggressive and reactive and just not coping in the world. And, you know, diet's so important, isn't it? It's so important.
Yeah. And it's why I got into the whole holistic approach. And it's looking at those pillars of well-being and what is really impacting the reactivity. And nutrition is one of those four pillars. So it's really, really important to consider.
So I just want to ask about, you know, obviously the meals that we feed our dogs, that's really important to be aware of how that might affect their behavior. But what about chews? What about treats? Because some of the chews and treats are, well, some of them look really kind of like fake plastic. Some of them are really colorful. And can that affect our dog's behavior as well?
It can, but more in the short term. So if you think about chews and treats and how much of the daily portion they actually contribute to, it's a lot lower than the actual food, and you might not feed them every day. So if you do feed kind of a high sugar content chew or something like that, it's much more in the immediate term that you will see the impacts. So
that spike of, yeah.
Yeah. So you can typically, the ones that are available in the supermarkets, the ones that everyone goes, oh, I feed my dog this brand once a day, and it helps keep their mouth nice and healthy.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that one.
And you will notice most likely that your dog's energy levels shortly after having one will actually skyrocket up, and then they will plummet back down to earth. Which isn't brilliant, because really what you want is to be able to have that nice regulation of blood sugar through the day. If your dog consistently has those peaks and troughs of blood sugar, you're actually predisposing them to diabetes as well. So it's really important to try and regulate it as much as possible. Instead of feeding, I am going to use that horrible word, processed. Instead of feeding those kind of more processed chews that have had a bundle of ingredients all mashed together and then stuck into a shape, think of what you can feed that's more natural chews, because there are an incredible number of, I say it in inverted commas, natural chews available. What I'm meaning when I say natural is bits of body parts that have been air dried, or bits of meat that have just been stuck in a blender with no additives at all and then dried out. So you can get like little cylindrical tubes that are just pure venison meat or pure pheasant meat, for example, or you can get like dried rabbit's ears. Beef pizzles, I'm sure, are really popular. A lot of dogs love a beef pizzle. Let's not talk about what goes into them.
We won't describe what that is.
No.
You'll have to Google it.
Definitely Google, because it's interesting if you didn't know it already. But those kind of things are much healthier. And yes, they can have quite high fat contents, but it's much better to have a higher fat content than a high sugar and carb content. So just have a look. And if you do have a more overweight chai, or you need something that's a little bit lower in calories, you can opt for the leaner meat options as well. So things like ostrich or turkey are really low in fat and can really help dogs that are a bit chubby up to still have those chew options. And then the same goes for treats as well. I saw an article in the Telegraph really recently that got my blood boiling a little bit, in that someone said that the only treat we ever need for our dogs is chunks of courgette. And as trainers and behaviourists here, I think we can all just say, if that was all we ever used for our dogs would be absolutely running amok, and they would have no idea what to do with themselves, because it's not very motivational. Really, really healthy as a vegetable for your dog. Absolutely. If they like courgette, use courgette. But good luck training a recall with a bit of courgette in your hand.
Yeah.
It just would not happen in this house. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
It just would not happen.
My dog would just sniff it and just go, no, I'm going back to bed. Yeah. I'm going back off to chase this squirrel.
It smells like water. I'm not coming back for that.
Exactly. But then, as long as you're taking care of the amount of treats that you're giving, general rule of thumb is about 10% of the daily ration. Technically, you should be calculating that on ME, which is metabolizable energy, but just do it 10% gram for gram, and you can always reduce them if you start seeing some weight go on to your dog. As long as you're being careful with the weight and how much you're given, it doesn't really matter what treats you're using, because you're trying to walk that fine line in between training and nutrition anyway. So as long as they're a nice, healthy weight, you shouldn't worry too much about it.
And I guess a lot of the time you can use some of your dog's daily portions anyway for training, can't you? You can take a little bit of out of their meals to use for training.
Absolutely.
Like kibble and, yeah.
Yeah. And it's a technique I also advise for a lot of fussy eaters. And I'm sure that you've had this a lot, both of you as well, in that there are an awful lot of fussy eaters out there. And sometimes even just working for their food makes it feel more valuable. And so even if you just go have their portion of food in your hand and you just do a little training session in the kitchen for it, it doesn't have to be serious training. It can just be trick training. They're actually going to enjoy their kibble more because it's perceived as more valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. So I apologise to the listeners well in advance here, because they may be eating dinner or they may be having a snack of some kind. But we need to talk about poop eating, chihuahuas eating their own poop or other animals. Now, I'm sure there are plenty of people listening to this episode right now that has a chihuahua that does this from time to time. And poop eating seems pretty disgusting to us. However, can you explain why they do this, Alyssa? And is there something we need to be worried about? And is there something that in their diet that we need to change? And what can people do about it?
Really, really good question. In fact, data from about 2018 suggests that a fifth, 20% of our dogs eat their own or other dog poo. Even more of those dogs also eat things like horse and cat poo. When I think about poo eating, and please correct me if you're thinking about something else, I'm thinking specifically about dogs that eat their own and other dogs' poo, rather than horse poo, things like that. And again, this really interesting paper came out a few years ago that basically started work on working out exactly why they do this, because the jury is still out. We don't have a definite answer as to why our dogs like to eat poo, but we have a few different theories. So one of them is that it's a nutritional deficiency. They're trying to pick up something in either their own or another dog's poo that can help correct that. In the same breath, a lot of nutrition is also dependent on the bacteria in the gut. So more than 90% of our genetic material and that of our dogs is made up of the bacteria that lives inside them, rather than their actual genetic material. And the bacteria have a huge influence on their digestion, what they actually absorb and what they excrete. So eating another dog's poo, for example, could be a way to give their bacteria a little bit more nutrition that helps support them and therefore help support the dog's overall nutrition. But it is also really interesting that there's a correlation between dogs that eat poo and dogs that are perceived by their owners to be greedy eaters. So that inhale their food in like a few gulps, or that scavenge all the time. So it could be that there's a little satiety thing going on, and it's dogs that eat poo maybe feel a little bit more hungry. So again, you could change their diet more in terms of how they're fed rather than what they're being fed. So you might think, okay, I might break up their 2 meals a day into 4 meals a day and spread them throughout so that they have that continued feeling of hunger for a little bit longer. But then another theory is that it's purely behavioral. It's adaptive behavior, which is where they've picked it up from their mum. We know that there's a big correlation in poo eating dogs. If their mum was seen to be eating poo when the pups were 5 to 7 weeks old, the pups are much more likely to be eating poo as well.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, really, really interesting. And of course, a lot of mum dogs do eat poo because they're trying to clean the
desk. Yes, of course. Yeah.
Where the theory comes from. Most dogs that are termed coprophagic, which means eating poo, they will only eat poo that is 2 days old or fresher. And if it gets to older than 2 days, they'll ignore it. And
right.
That handily coincides with a little bit of a life cycle of some parasitic worms, where if they eat the poo when it's super fresh, they actually eat the poo with the worm eggs in it, but the worm eggs won't develop. They won't develop and kind of germinate, for lack of a better word, worms, until it's been passed through the dog again, further away from the home area. And that timeline for egg to worm is 2 days. So if they eat them after that 2 days, they're more likely to become infested with worms themselves. So it's a really interesting little theory about adaptive biology there and adaptive behavior. Because
fascinating.
Yeah,
absolutely fascinating.
There's so many different correlations there that we're not sure what exactly is going on, but it is quite a disgusting behavior to get into. It's not hygienic, obviously.
So it's not nice, is it? It is disgusting.
Yeah. If you can get it out of your dog, it's a really good idea to try things that can work. Now, the big difference comes in is if your dog is just eating their own poo, just eating other dog's poo, or eating both, because then you need to start playing around with it. You tend to have a lot more success with this if you start from when they're baby puppies, so when they first come to you. But a lot, it's not a behavior that puppies grow out of. You do need to intervene. So I always refer to the flower pot trick, which is where if you know your puppy is eating their own poop in the garden, you just supervise them all the time. As soon as they've pooped, you pop a flower pot over it. And then you go and pick it up when they're off in the house and they can't see you, because then they don't see you as picking it up and going, oh, I'm going to go and hide this poo in my big hoard of dog poo. They just say, oh, it's under the flower pot. I can't eat it. I'm out. And then you can clear it up in your own space.
I love that idea. Flower pot, probably maybe a rock or something, or a brick on top, because you know, a lot of dogs would probably topple it over. But yeah. I love that flower pot on the poop. Brilliant.
Yeah, and it's just always a really good idea to work on lead around poo. So again, working with a behaviorist is really helpful for this. If I say counter conditioning, disengagement training, I'm sure you guys know what I'm on about, but the general public maybe don't. So have a chat with your local force-free trainer or behaviorist about how you can impact your dog's poo eating behavior using disengagement training. One of my colleagues and friends has recently done this with good success by putting some dog poo in Tupperware boxes with little holes in. So bit of a dirty job, but it does the job. That's what you need it to. But yeah, there's loads of things that you can look into. So if in doubt for your own dog, always chat to a professional about it, because they'll be able to tailor it down.
It's always something you can do with training, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It's interesting you say that you think that as a general rule, puppies don't grow out of it. Mm. It becomes a practiced habit, becomes a self-reinforcing habit of poo eating.
So there is data out there that says that the vast majority of poo eating dogs are the older dogs above about 4 years old. So it tends to be one that, if anything, it gets worse with age rather than
wow.
Yeah, but yeah, it's something that also can very easily become a learned response. And more often than not, it's not because they really love the taste of it. It's not because of anything like that. It's because what happens when they eat poo, their owner starts to chase them and it turns into a massive game.
Yep.
They start to go, it's similar to slippers. Yeah. And they'll just go, oh, I really want to play a game with you. I don't know how to initiate this, so I'm just going to eat this poo and then you chase me and then we're playing. Yay. So it's really important to consider that as well if you've got a poo eater.
Yeah. So if you have a puppy right now that started to eat poo, I think I don't want it to get it any worse. Just supervise them, use the flower pot trick, clean it up when the puppy's not looking. And then if it's still, you know, it's still quite, they're still eating poo and it's still becoming a habit, probably enlist the help of a trainer.
Absolutely.
To help you do some disengagement and stuff like that. And Yeah.
And I would say, well, just on this subject, there are so many food additives that you can buy that you can put on top of dogs' foods that is meant to make their poo taste disgusting.
Isn't pineapple one of them? Or is that
one of the natural remedies? Yeah. And then there's loads of like the pharmaceutical brands have them as well. And it's meant to help. Again, very limited data on it. You don't tend to see an awful lot of significant difference. So it's not really working for a lot of cases. And also, I feel like it goes without saying, but some people have not really thought about it. If you're using it to stop your dog eating other dog's poo, it's not going to work because it won't affect the other dog's poo, just your own dog's poo.
So you mentioned there about using supplements to help with poo eating. Are there any other supplements or additional ingredients that you would absolutely 100% recommend that people add to their 2 hours meals on a day-to-day basis to promote optimal health?
Honestly, no. Okay. It depends completely on their diet. So supplements can be used to make up for deficiencies in their diet and round it out to make sure that the right things are being kind of promoted. So it very much comes down again to the individual, what health issues they might be facing, what behavior issues they might be facing, and what they're already being fed on, because it's a whole picture affair. So I can't blanketly say absolutely always feed this one supplement, because it might be that the active ingredients in that supplement are already well met within the core diet for that dog. So it's one that if you are interested in supplementing for your dog, or you think that there's something where nutrition might be lacking for them, chat to your vets, chat to a dog nutritionist, and work it out for them individually, because just subscribing to an one size fits all approach isn't going to work. It needs to be tailored down.
That's really interesting. So, well, that's answered that question. I was like, oh, she's going to give us loads of ideas there. But yeah, no, it does make perfect sense.
So something else I did really want to say on that actually is that there is a trend going on where everyone and their mum seems to be recommending giving your dog a probiotic. Probiotics can be incredibly helpful because obviously they're full of really beneficial bacteria for your dog's gut. However, you might just be wasting your money because we don't know enough yet about our dog's microbiome, what slant needs to be in terms of in the microbiome, which is all the bacteria in the gut. You've got hundreds, thousands, even millions of different communities of different types of bacteria, different species of bacteria. We don't know enough really yet about all of those different species and what is an optimal community for them to be able to say, this probiotic is going to be great for your dog. This probiotic is going to be great for your dog. We've literally just started to see microbiome testing coming out to help us analyze the bacterial communities in our dogs. But without knowing that information, we shouldn't really be putting in a probiotic unless there's an actual symptom that's making us go, we think the bacteria is off kilter here. So, for example, if they're always having runny poo, a probiotic, absolutely go for it. But as a blanket approach for every dog, once again, it's not always the solution. It might be that you need more of a prebiotic to support the bacteria that are already in the gut. Or it might be that the bacteria are doing just fine. It might be that you need a diet change. There's so many different things that go into it. So once again, it takes me back to that main point of don't think because, oh, your best friend's feeding their dog this supplement and it's worked wonders. Don't fall into the trap of thinking you then need to feed that same supplement to your dog.
Yeah, so individual, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah,
I do give Bo, and she really loves it, sometimes kefir yogurt. She absolutely goes crazy for it. It's like she needs it, she wants it, and she does get some gut issues. I have to be very careful with what I feed her. I've found a food now that she really likes and she does really well on, but I do also give her a little bit of kefir as well. So what are your thoughts on that?
Kefir is fantastic. Really, really nice. It's a good little supplement.
She loves it.
Yeah, it's a lovely little food product. And, you know, it can be really useful as well if you put it in Kongs or Licky Mats and things like that.
Yeah.
Calmness. But no, it's one of those that is a lovely little food source in moderation.
Yeah.
You don't want to go to town. But no, it's a lovely option and it does have some really nice little bacteria qualities to it. And it's not as expensive as a probiotic in and of itself. So, you know, that is something that you could feed. I wouldn't recommend feeding it every day all the time, but yeah, little bits here and there. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I would say not the only thing here is look out for sugar content. As long as it's not got the added sugars or the flavors and stuff in it, then it's fine.
No, but yeah. She's really into it.
bless her.
That's so I just assume that she needs it for her gut needs it.
Yeah. And you know, that is very much a thing. Like, the behavior changes if they need something. We've seen it in humans, we've seen it in wild animals, we definitely see it in our dogs. If they need something biochemically, their behavior shifts to help them get it. It's just like pregnancy cravings.
Yeah. And this takes me on to the next question about grass eating, because my dog Bo will actually get me up early in the morning so she can go and eat grass. And I know usually it's because she's not feeling very well, or she's lacking in something. So the question is, why do our chihuahuas eat grass, or why do dogs eat grass, and how much should they be eating? But if they don't have access to grass, should we be providing grass for them?
Really, really good question. And I think it kind of goes hand in hand with the poop eating question, in terms of, we don't have definitive answers. There was a little kind of spurt of a flurry of research into it around the 2010s, but it seems to have died out a little bit now, and we still don't have conclusive answers. But a lot of the theories are that they're using it as an emetic, so to help themselves throw up, that they're using it even as a laxative because it's extra fiber, so it can help tunnel things through the gut, that they licking it or eating it because it's got nice moisture content, especially early in the morning, and maybe they're dehydrated. We notice that an awful lot of dogs don't necessarily enjoy drinking from their water bowl. They prefer drinking from outside sources of rainwater and things. Moisture on the grass would give a really good source of that. Of course, you've got the bacteria argument again. So there's bacteria living on everything, so that could be impacting it. But actually, the most common reason why dogs do it is because they're hungry. Not saying that that is exhaustive, that that is all dogs do it because they're hungry, but dogs are more prone to doing it if they've gone a long time without food, or if they're in between meal times and they're a bit more on the hungry side, say it's an hour before their tea time or something, they're more prone to do it in those moments. This is another one that is really heavily influenced by their mum. So if they see their mum doing it again in that little window of 5 to 7 weeks, makes them really, really prone to doing it themselves later on in life. Generally, the data says that very few dogs will actually, in the grand scheme of things anyway, very few dogs will actually throw up once they've eaten grass, which is really interesting. So there's a movement away from that kind of vomit inducing theory, but I still think it has a place, because we know some dogs definitely do that. It's just maybe not the majority of the population. We've already mentioned the hunger one. My own dog eats grass more when he's hungry, so I see that a lot in him. But interestingly, now this one isn't in the research or the data as much, but I've tended to notice among my client base anyway, so predominantly anxious dogs anyway, so there's a bit of a skew, a lot of the anxious dogs eat grass in or around having a bit of a reactivity meltdown. So when they're at their prime anxiousness, as it were, and it tends to be almost like a comforting behaviour, which, you know, you could also say about when you see dogs scratching on the ground with their back feet, that also happens around those more anxiety inducing times. So it's not, I mean, Mark Beckhoff had a brilliant book the other year called, I think it was Confidential Canine or Canine Confidential. And he went into detail about the scratching of the back feet and how that's not always related to having just defecated or something. It's not related to just scent marking. It's also related to a load of other things. And I think the same is true for grass eating. It's got so many different options that can feed into it, and there's nothing to say it's just one for each dog. And again, it will be different for every individual dog. I sound a bit like a broken record. I think from the research, the chances are it's because they're hungry, but we've still got that myriad of other options to be looking at that could still be playing a role. And it comes down to those three crucial words that I think we all need to be really comfortable with saying sometimes, which is, I don't know. And none of us know, because the science hasn't been conclusive yet. And until that day, we won't know for sure. And even after that day, we probably won't know for sure, because there's always going to be new science coming out to disprove and tweak things.
Oh. Yep, like always. It's always happening. But Bo, my dog Bo, she's never, ever been sick after eating grass. It's like she needs it. It's supplementing something. She's feeling better after eating it. And yeah, it usually is. Like, she has a real need for it. It's usually in the morning before breakfast. I can easily just feed her, but she wants to go and eat grass first. It's not every morning. So that's really interesting you say about the hunger thing.
Yeah.
Kiri, however, sometimes when she eats grass, she is sick, but very rarely. So I guess it depends on the individual dog, but they like eating grass. They like to eat specific grass, especially at this time of year, the spring, the new grass coming through. I allow them to do as much grazing as possible because they seem to really enjoy it. They relax doing it, and they obviously they need it. So I was just really interested.
And that just actually reminded me of the last part of your question that I forgot to answer, which is if they don't have access to grass, should we be providing them with some? Mm. And I think yes, not necessarily for them to eat. So it's not a matter of going out and trimming some grass in the park and bringing it home. But I think grass is very important in terms of environment. And it's really important to, if you can, say you're living with your chihuahua in a block of flats in a built up city area. If you can, maybe once a week, try and take them out of the city to a park or a green area so that they can experience and interact with the environment that's more grassy, more vegetation, because it provides them with an awful lot more of behavioural outlets to help them do all the natural behaviours that they need to do, as well as the chance to eat grass if they feel it's necessary for them.
Yeah, it's almost like it's like a mental enrichment for them. It's like an enriching activity to do. It's like a social activity almost. Yeah. For my two dogs, one will start eating, and then the other one like, oh, I'm going to eat grass too. And it's lovely watching them. They'll both be eating grass. And they'll get really close together, and they'll be eating, you know, choosing the blades that they want to eat. It's fascinating, really.
The three of them go out there.
It's social activity, right?
It is that little social gathering that they have.
It's really interesting to me as well, because you will probably come across certain dog food advocates out there that are going down the line of dogs are carnivores, they're not omnivores. And I think the fact that, I mean, we know that around 95% of dogs eat grass. So it's a very, very big part of the population. The very fact that they're eating grass suggests they're not exclusively carnivores. They are omnivores, which then I have to say it does back up the science looking at their gastrointestinal tract makeup as well as their dentition and how their teeth are formed. They are omnivores. They're not carnivores. I just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah, no, it's a really, really good point. So if someone doesn't have access to the outside and they can't get the chihuahua out to, you know, eat grass, could they get a pot of wheatgrass in their house?
It's not something I'd ever
could they
thought.
Buy something or...
And I would actually advise against it just to be safe, because anything that's grown commercially, you don't know what's on it in terms of whether it's got any pesticides or anything on it. And it's not essential for their well-being.
No.
So I would probably advise don't worry about bringing in turf or anything like that. If you did want to do that, you could use it more of like we mentioned before, a mental enrichment kind of opportunity I used to work in zoos and zoo animal behavior training and welfare and nutrition, and all of that. And something we used to do for mental enrichment there was to dig up a sod of earth that still had grass on it from various parts and then move it into certain enclosures, because it gives them freshness, fresh opportunities to dig around in it. There's also obviously going to be like little invertebrates and insects in it, and they get the grass to eat if they want to. Mm-hmm. Rather than growing a source in your home, if you wanted to, I'm not saying you have to, you could go out, get a plant pot of just some dirt from outside with some grassy bits in it and bring it in. What I would say, though, is try not to chop the grass. Don't give them any grass cuttings or anything from a lawn, because that gives off a different chemical that can be quite harmful.
Okay.
Make sure that it's fresh if you do want to go down that route.
Yeah.
So when it comes to nutrition, very much like with behavior and training, it's very much deal with the dog in front of you, teach the dog in front of you, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's very few one size fits all approaches that work. And I think as well, it's a really interesting thought to follow up on as well, is that more and more we are seeing food companies that are purporting to tailor make your dog's food for them based on their needs, them as an individual. I'm not being funny. As a business model, that will not work, because they would have to do an awful lot of testing on your individual dog, an awful lot of nutrition counselling for your individual dog to make sure that the nutrition is specifically tailored to them. It might be that it's tailored to an itchy dog that's got persistent scratchiness. It might be that it's tailored to a dog with a sensitive tummy that always has runny poos or something like that, but it's not going to be tailored to your individual dog. The true art and epitome of nutrition is if you can do that with a qualified canine nutritionist. But then again, it comes back to what works for you. Does that work for your lifestyle? Can you afford to do that? And we end up back at the beginning again.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what about breed-specific food? So food that's targeted at chihuahuas?
Generally, I don't think it's necessary. So there's a lot of science again out there suggesting that there is a more diversity within a breed than between breeds, whilst, you know, looking at the size of the stomach and things like that, obviously that's going to be pretty consistent, but the actual makeup of the food will still depend hugely on the individual and what they need, even down to what their past experience was like, what their weaning experience was like, what their mum ate when they were in the womb. All of those things will play into their gut health. So it can't be a breed specific thing. Mm-hmm. And sadly, what you see with most of those breed specific foods is it is purely a marketing gambit where they've just gone, we want to target this industry. So we're going to go in with a bag of food that just says Chihuahua on it and a little picture of a cute Chihuahua, in the hope that then people, not knowing any better, because very few of us actually do, will then just go, oh, so it must have been tailor-made to a Chihuahua, it'll be perfect. Yeah. The sad reality is that it'll be the same recipe as things for like Dachshunds. It'll probably even be the same recipe as a Labrador, just in a smaller bite kibble. So that's where the kibble is smaller than the big blocks that you can feed a Labrador. That's going to be the primary difference. So I really wouldn't worry about going breed specific at all.
Thank you.
Gosh, that's very sneaky, isn't it?
Yeah, it's marketing. A lot of the dog food industry is marketing. And it's why in a lot of the work I do around education for dog nutrition, I always say, leave your heart at the door. You have to go into this with your head. You can't go, I love the packaging, it really speaks to me, the dog on the packet looks just like my Dougal or anything like that. You've got to go in, don't even look at the front of the bag, flip it right over and have a look at the ingredients, because it's the only way you're going to get what's right.
Yeah, absolutely. I read somewhere that leaving a bag of dried food unused for 2 weeks or more can cause an oxidization process which turns the fats in that food rancid, which for some dogs may be a factor of fussiness for those chihuahuas that are picky eaters. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely true. Definitely does happen. So when it says unused, I just want to clarify that is if it's left open to the air, if it's
right, okay,
sealed in its packet. It does tend to have a shelf life depending on the preservatives used. If it uses natural preservatives like vitamin E, usually a shelf life of about a year. If it uses more synthetic preservatives, more like BHA, which aren't as brilliant, you get a longer shelf life, but you do have some risk factors associated with them as well. But if it is left open to the air, that's where the issues start coming from. So even though it does work out as more cost effective to get a bigger bag of food, I would always suggest going for the smaller bags because it stays fresher for longer. And if you can, try and decant it into an airtight container. Mm. And airtight is really important there. Not just one of the standard dog food bins that you can pick up at pet shops. Get one that is airtight, because it just needs to stop the flow of air going around it. As that person said, yes, it does turn the fats rancid. A lot of the time, the fats, so especially if it's been preserved with vitamin E, it'll be sprayed onto the outside of the kibble, so it's the surface. And then it does oxidize with the air and turn itself rancid. So yeah, that contributes to fussiness, and it can contribute to what's called free radicals in the body as well. So you need to eat more antioxidants because it contributes towards all sorts of problems. So if you can, basically get your small bag of kibble, empty into an airtight container, and then only open it in between servings. What's even better than that is if you decant it into several airtight containers, because then you're not letting in air every time you feed it. So you might have like a tower of airtight containers that you just decant it into, and then you can just open like one every couple of days, and that will stop that oxidization process.
Yeah,
that's really okay. Good advice. I'm definitely guilty of buying the bigger bag.
Well, I've got a bag here. It's like a 2 kg. I use it for treats and a little bit of in their meals as well. But it's in there in a sealed bag. Yeah. Do I need to put it into a few Tupperware boxes? Do you think, or just is it okay in there? It's been there for about 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'd say because you're feeding it primarily as treats and not in meals, you're going to take longer to go through it. So I would suggest decanting it into a few different Tupperwares, just because every time you open up that bag, you're letting in a fresh bout of air. And it's going to keep that process going. So if you can split it out into smaller boxes, you'll be reducing that airflow across it in general, and you'll be able to use it then for longer without it going off.
Brilliant. Well, I will be doing that.
Yeah, Yes, me too.
Thank you.
I also saw that dust mites can accumulate on food that if it's left and exacerbate skin conditions, so skin issues and allergies. What are your thoughts on that?
Again, can happen, like everything in the home, if it's left open to the air, dust mites can get to it and then they can just proliferate all over it. So again, best way to prevent is airtight containers, exactly the same as for the oxidization stuff, just to prevent them getting onto it in the first place and then reproducing. The trick is basically to try and keep it as sterile as possible. So really try and keep it away from everything that might encourage dust mites as well. So keep it away from any like soft furnishings, things like that, just to be on the safe side.
Very good. All very useful, very, very helpful advice. Yeah, fascinating. So Alyssa, how can people find out about you and your work?
Yep. So I've got my website. So my consultancy is called Holistic Pet Services. That's H-O-L-I-S-T-I-C Pet Services. The website is www.holisticpetservices.co.uk, or we're on pretty much all of the social medias at Holistic Pets UK. So that's going to be the best way to find me. If you just wanted to read some more information that I've created for dog owners, then you can also check out a load of that on the blog page at yourdogsclub.co.uk, which is an e-commerce site for dogs selling just like ethical stuff and dog food that is above board. But all of the education is on there as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Fantastic. And we will put all of that into the show notes. It's been absolutely fascinating. Yeah, so much information. And I just know that people are going to get so much value out of this.
I really hope that you've enjoyed this episode in our Industry Expert series with Alyssa Ralph. If you haven't already, please make sure to go and check out our previous episodes in the series. And as usual, please remember to like, follow, subscribe wherever you listen to the podcasts. You can find us on Facebook at The Chihuahua Podcast. You can email us at thechihuahuapodcast@gmail.com. And we will catch you next time with another Industry Expert.